As he waited for the trial to begin, Blomqvist glanced around at the other spectators. He caught sight of Armansky sitting near the exit, and their eyes met for a moment. Ekstrom had a large stack of papers on his table. He greeted several journalists. Giannini sat at her table across from Ekstrom. She had her head down and was sorting through her papers. Blomqvist thought his sister looked a bit tense. Stage fright, he supposed. Then the judge assessor and lay assessors entered the courtroom. Judge Jorgen Iversen was a white-haired, 57-year-old man with a gaunt face and a spring in his step. Blomqvist had researched Iversen's background and found that he was an exacting judge of long experience who had presided over many high-profile cases. Finally, Salander was brought into the courtroom. Even though Blomqvist was used to Salander's penchant for shocking clothing, he was amazed that his sister had allowed her to show up to the courtroom in a black leather miniskirt with frayed seams and a black top, with the legend "I am annoyed," which barely covered her many tattoos. She had 10 piercings in her ears and a ring through her left eyebrow. Her head was covered in 3 months' worth of uneven stubble after her surgery. She wore grey lipstick and more black mascara than Blomqvist had ever seen her wear. Her eyebrows were heavily darkened. In the days when he and Salander had spent time together, she had shown almost no interest in makeup. She looked a bit vulgar, to put it mildly. It was almost a goth look. She reminded him of a vampire in some pop art movie from the 60s. Blomqvist was aware of some of the reporters in the press gallery catching their breath in astonishment or smiling broadly. They were at last getting a look at the scandal-ridden young woman they had written so much about, and she was certainly living up to all their expectations. Then he realized that Salander was in costume. Usually her style was sloppy and rather tasteless. Blomqvist had assumed that she was not really interested in fashion, but that she tried instead to accentuate her own individuality. Salander had always seemed to mark her private space as hostile territory, and he had thought of the rivets in her leather jacket as a defense mechanism, like the quills of a hedgehog. To everyone around her, it was as good a signal as any. "Don't try to touch me, it will hurt." But here in the district court, she had exaggerated her style to the point of parody. It was no accident. It was part of Giannini's strategy. If Salander had come in with her hair smoothed down and wearing a twin set and pearls and sensible shoes, she would have come across as a con artist trying to sell a story to the court. It was a question of credibility. She had come as herself and no one else. Way over the top. For clarity. She was not pretending to be someone she was not. Her message to the court was that she had no reason to be ashamed or to put on a show. If the court had a problem with her appearance, it was no concern of hers. The state had accused her of a multitude of things, and the prosecutor had dragged her into court. With her very appearance, she had already indicated that she intended to brush aside the prosecutor's accusations as nonsense. She moved with confidence and sat down next to her lawyer. She surveyed the spectators. There was no curiosity in her gaze. She seemed instead to be defiantly observing and registering those who had already convicted her in the press. It was the first time Blomqvist had seen her since she lay like a bloody rag doll on the bench in that kitchen in Gossaberger, and a year and a half or more since he had last seen her under normal circumstances. If the term "normal circumstances" could ever be used in connection with Salander. For a matter of seconds, their eyes met. Hers lingered on him, but she betrayed no sign of recognition. Yet she did seem to study the bruises that covered Blomqvist's cheek and temple, and the surgical tape over his right eyebrow. Blomqvist thought he discerned the merest hint of a smile in her eyes, but could not be sure he had not imagined it. Then Judge Iversen pounded his gavel and called the court to order. The spectators were allowed to be present in the courtroom for all of 30 minutes. They listened to Ekstrom's introductory presentation of the case. Every reporter except Blomqvist was busily taking notes, even though by now all of them knew the charges Ekstrom intended to bring. Blomqvist had already written his story. Ekstrom's introductory remarks went on for 22 minutes. Then it was Giannini's turn. Her presentation took 30 seconds. Her voice was firm. "The defense rejects all the charges brought against my client, except one. She admits to possession of an illegal weapon. That is one spray canister of mace. To all other counts, my client pleads not guilty of criminal intent. We will show that the prosecutor's assertions are flawed and that my client has been subjected to grievous violations of her civil rights. I will demand that my client be acquitted of all charges, that her declaration of incompetence be revoked, and that she be released. There was a murmuring from the press gallery. Advocate Giannini's strategy had at last been revealed. It was obviously not what the reporters had been expecting. Most had speculated that Giannini would in some way exploit her client's mental illness to her advantage. Blomqvist smiled.
"I see,"
Judge Everson said, making a swift note. He looked at Giannini.
"Are you finished?"
"That is my presentation."
"Does the prosecutor have anything to add?"
Judge Everson said. It was at this point that Ekstrom requested a private meeting in the judge's chambers. There he argued that the case hinged upon one vulnerable individual's mental state and welfare, and that it also involved matters which, if explored before the public in court, could be detrimental to national security.
"I assume that you are referring to what may be termed the Zalichenko affair," Judge Everson said. "That is correct. Alexander Zalichenko came to Sweden as a political refugee and sought asylum from a terrible dictatorship. There are elements in the handling of his situation, personal connections and the like, that are still classified, even though Herr Zalichenko is now deceased. I therefore request that the deliberations be held behind closed doors and that a rule of confidentiality be applied to those sections of the deliberations that are particularly sensitive."
"I believe I understand your point," Judge Everson said, knitting his brows.
"In addition, a large part of the deliberations will deal with the defendant's guardianship. This touches on matters which in all normal cases become classified almost automatically, and it is out of respect for the defendant that I am requesting a closed court."
"How does Advocate Giannini respond to the prosecutor's request?"
"For our part, it makes no difference." Judge Everson consulted his assessor and then returned to the courtroom and announced, to the annoyance of the reporters present, that he had accepted the prosecutor's request. So Blomqvist left the courtroom. Armansky waited for Blomqvist at the bottom of the stairs in the courthouse. It was sweltering in the July heat, and Blomqvist could feel sweat in his armpits. His two bodyguards joined him as he emerged from the courthouse. Both nodded to Armansky and then busied themselves studying the surroundings.
"It feels strange to be walking around with bodyguards," Blomqvist said. "What's all this going to cost?"
"It's on the firm. I have a personal interest in keeping you alive. But since you ask, we've spent roughly 250,000 kroner on pro bono work in the past few months."
"Coffee?" Blomqvist said, pointing to the Italian cafe on Bergsgarten. Blomqvist ordered a latte and Armansky a double espresso with a teaspoon of milk. They sat in the shade on the sidewalk outside. The bodyguards sat at the next table drinking cokes.
"Closed court," Armansky said.
"That was expected. And it's okay, since it means that we can control the news flow better."
"You're right. It doesn't matter to us. But my opinion of Prosecutor Ekstrom is sinking fast," Armansky said.
They drank their coffee and contemplated the courthouse in which Salander's future would be decided.
"Custer's last stand," Blomqvist said.
"She is well prepared," Armansky said. "And I must say I'm impressed with your sister. When she began planning her strategy, I thought it made no sense, but the more I think about it, the more effective it seems."
"This trial won't be decided in there," Blomqvist said.
He had been repeating these words like a mantra for several months.
"You're going to be called as a witness," Armansky said.
"I know.
I'm ready.
But it won't happen before the day after tomorrow. At least that's what we're counting on."
Ekstrom had left his reading glasses at home and had to push his glasses up onto his forehead and squint to be able to read the last-minute handwritten additions to his text. He stroked his blonde goatee before he readjusted his glasses once more and surveyed the room. Salander sat with her back ramrod straight and gave the prosecutor an unfathomable look. Her face and eyes were impassive, and she did not appear to be wholly present. It was time for the prosecutor to begin questioning her.
"I would like to remind Fröken Salander that she is speaking under oath," Ekstrom said at last.
Salander did not move a muscle. Prosecutor Ekstrom seemed to be anticipating some sort of response, and waited for a few seconds. He looked at her expectantly.
"You are speaking under oath," he said.
Salander tilted her head very slightly. Giannini was busy reading something in the preliminary investigation protocol and seemed unconcerned by whatever Prosecutor Ekstrom was saying. Ekstrom shuffled his papers. After an uncomfortable silence, he cleared his throat.
"Very well, then," Ekstrom said. "Let us proceed directly to the events at the late Advocate Bierman's summer cabin outside Stallarholmen on April 6th of this year, which was the starting point of my presentation of the case this morning. We shall attempt to bring clarity to how it happened that you drove down to Stallarholmen and shot Carl Magnus Lundin."
Ekstrom gave Salander a challenging look. Still, she did not move a muscle. The prosecutor suddenly seemed resigned. He threw up his hands and looked pleadingly at the judge. Judge Everson seemed wary. He glanced at Giannini, who was still engrossed in some papers, apparently unaware of her surroundings. Judge Everson cleared his throat. He looked at Salander.
"Are we to interpret your silence to mean that you don't want to answer any questions?" he asked.
Salander turned her head and met Judge Everson's eyes.
"I will gladly answer questions," she said.
Judge Everson nodded.
"Then perhaps you can answer the question," Ekstrom put it.
Salander looked at Ekstrom and said nothing.
"Could you please answer the question?" Judge Everson urged her.
Salander looked back at the judge and raised her eyebrows. Her voice was clear and distinct.
"Which question? Until now that man there," she nodded towards Ekstrom, "has made a number of unverified statements. I haven't yet heard a question."
Giannini looked up. She propped her elbow on the table and leaned her chin on her hand with an interested expression. Ekstrom lost his train of thought for a few seconds.
"Could you please repeat the question?" Judge Everson said.
"I asked whether you drove down to Advocate Bierman's summer cabin in Stallarholmen with the intention of shooting Carl Magnus Lundin."
"No.
You said that you were going to try to bring clarity to how it happened that I drove down to Stallarholmen and shot Carl Magnus Lundin.
That was not a question. It was a general assertion in which you anticipated my answer. I'm not responsible for the assertions you are making."
"Don't quibble. Answer the question."
"No."
Silence.
"No what?"
"No is my answer to the question."
Prosecutor Ekstrom sighed. This was going to be a long day. Salander watched him expectantly.
"It might be best to take this from the beginning," he said. "Were you at the late Advocate Bierman's summer cabin in Stallarholmen on the afternoon of April 6th this year?"
"Yes."
"How did you get there?"
"I went by shuttle train to Södertälje and took the Strängnäs bus."
"What was your reason for going to Stallarholmen? Had you arranged a meeting there with Carl Magnus Lundin and his friend Sonny Niemenen?"
"No."
"How was it that they showed up there?"
"You'll have to ask them that.
I'm asking you."
Salander did not reply. Judge Everson cleared his throat.
"I presume that Fröken Salander is not answering because, purely semantically, you have once again made an assertion," the judge said helpfully.
Giannini suddenly snickered just loud enough to be heard. She pulled herself together at once and studied her papers again. Ekstrom gave her an irritated glance.
"Why do you think Lundin and Niemenen went to Bierman's summer cabin?"
"I don't know. I suspect that they went there to commit arson. Lundin had half a gallon of gasoline in a plastic bottle in the saddlebag of his Harley Davidson."
Ekstrom pursed his lips.
"Why did you go to Advocate Bierman's summer cabin?"
"I was looking for information."
"What sort of information?"
"The information that I suspect Lundin and Niemenen were there to destroy, and which could contribute to clarifying who murdered the bastard."
"Is it your opinion that Advocate Bierman was a bastard? Is that correctly construed?"
"Yes."
"And why do you think that?"
"He was a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist, and therefore a bastard."
She was quoting the text that had been tattooed on the late Advocate Bierman's stomach, and thus indirectly admitting that she was responsible for it. This incident, however, was not included in the charges against Salander. Bierman had never filed a report of assault, and it would be impossible now to prove whether he had allowed himself to be tattooed or whether it had been done against his will.
In other words, you are alleging that your guardian forced himself on you. Can you tell the court when these assaults are supposed to have taken place?
They took place on Tuesday, February 18th, 2003, and again on Friday, March 7th of the same year.
You have refused to answer every question asked by the police in their attempts to interview you. Why?
I have nothing to say to them.
I have read the so-called autobiography that your lawyer delivered without warning a few days ago. I must say it is a strange document, and we'll come back to it in more detail later. But in it you claim that Advocate Bureman allegedly forced you to perform oral sex on the first occasion, and on the second subjected you to an entire night of repeated rape and severe torture.
Lisbeth did not reply.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Did you report the rapes to the police?
No.
Why not?
The police never listened before when I tried to tell them something, so there seemed no point in reporting anything to them then.
Did you discuss these assaults with any of your acquaintances? A girlfriend?
No.
Why not?
Because it's none of their business.
Did you try to contact a lawyer?
No.
Did you go to a doctor to be treated for the injuries you claim to have sustained?
No.
And you didn't go to any women's crisis centre either?
Now you're making an assertion again.
Excuse me. Did you go to any women's crisis centre?
No.
Ekstrom turned to the judge.
I want to make the court aware that the defendant has stated that she was subjected to sexual assaults on two occasions, the second of which should be considered exceptionally severe. The person she claims committed these rapes was her guardian, the late Niels Bureman. The following facts should be taken into account at this juncture. Ekstrom consulted the papers in front of him. In the investigation carried out by the Violent Crimes Division, there was nothing in Advocate Bureman's past to support the credibility of Lisbeth Salander's account. Bureman was never convicted of any crime. He has never been reported to the police or been the subject of an investigation. He had previously been a guardian or trustee to several other young people, none of whom have claimed that they were subjected to any sort of attack. On the contrary, they assert that Bureman invariably behaved correctly and kindly towards them. Ekstrom turned a page. It is also my duty to remind the court that Lisbeth Salander has been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. This is a young woman with a documented violent tendency, who since her early teens has had serious problems in her interactions with society. She spent several years in a children's psychiatric institution and has been under guardianship since the age of 18. However regrettable this may be, there are reasons for it. Lisbeth Salander is a danger to herself and to those around her. It is my conviction that she does not need a prison sentence. She needs psychiatric care.
He paused for effect.
Discussing a young person's mental state is an innately disagreeable task. So much is an invasion of privacy, and her mental state becomes the subject of interpretation. In this case, however, we have Lisbeth Salander's own confused worldview on which to base our decision. It becomes manifestly clear in what she has termed her autobiography. Nowhere is her want of a foothold in reality as evident as it is here. In this instance, we need no witnesses or interpretations to invariably contradict one another. We have her own words. We can judge for ourselves the credibility of her assertions.
His gaze fell on Salander. Their eyes met. She smiled. She looked malicious. Ekstrom frowned.
"Does Advocate Giannini have anything to say?"
Judge Everson said.
"No," Giannini said. "Other than that Prosecutor Ekstrom's conclusions are nonsensical."
The afternoon session began with the cross-examining of witnesses. The first was Ulrike von Liebenstahl from the Guardianship Agency. Ekstrom had called her to the stand to establish whether complaints had ever been lodged against Advocate Bureman. This was strongly denied by von Liebenstahl. Such assertions were defamatory.
"There exists a rigorous supervision of guardianship cases. Advocate Bureman had been active on behalf of the Guardianship Agency for almost 20 years before he was so shockingly murdered."
She gave Salander a withering look, despite the fact that Salander was not accused of murder. It had already been established that Bureman was murdered by Ronald Niedermann.
In all these years there has not been a single complaint against Advocate Bureman. He was a conscientious person who evidenced a deep commitment to his wards.
So you don't think it's plausible that he would have subjected Lisbeth Salander to aggravated sexual assault?
I think that statement is ridiculous. We have monthly reports from Advocate Bureman, and I personally met him on several occasions to go over the assignment.
Advocate Giannini has presented a request that Lisbeth Salander's guardianship be rescinded, effective immediately.
No one is happier than we who work at the agency when a guardianship can be rescinded. Unfortunately, we have a responsibility, which means that we have to follow the appropriate regulations. For the agency's part, we are required, in accordance with normal protocol, to see to it that Lisbeth Salander is declared fit by a psychiatric expert before there can be any talk of changes to her legal status.
I understand.
This means that she has to submit to a psychiatric examination, which, as everyone knows, she has refused to do.
The questioning of Ulrike von Riebenstahl lasted for about 40 minutes, during which time Bureman's monthly reports were examined. Giannini asked only one question before Ulrike von Riebenstahl was dismissed.
Were you in Advocate Bureman's bedroom on the night of March 7th, 2003?
Of course not.
In other words, you haven't the faintest idea whether my client's statement is true or not.
The accusation against Advocate Bureman is preposterous.
That is your opinion. Can you give him an alibi, or in any other way document, that he did not assault my client?
That's impossible, naturally. But the probability...
Thank you. That will be all, Giannini said.
Blomqvist met his sister at Milton's offices near Slusen at around 7 to go through the day's proceedings.
It was pretty much as expected, Giannini said. Ekstrom has bought Salander's autobiography.
Good. How's she holding up?
Giannini laughed.
She's holding up very well, coming across as a complete psychopath. She's merely being herself.
Wonderful.
Today has mostly been about what happened at the cabin in Stallarholmen. Tomorrow it'll be about Gosseberger, interrogations of people from forensics and so forth. Ekstrom is going to try to prove that Salander went down there intending to murder her father.
Well.
But we may have a technical problem. This afternoon Ekstrom called Ulrike von Liebenstahl from the guardianship agency. She started going on about how I had no right to represent Lisbeth.
Why?
She says that Lisbeth is under guardianship and therefore isn't entitled to choose her own lawyer. So, technically, I may not be her lawyer if the guardianship agency hasn't rubber-stamped it.
And?
Judge Everson is going to decide tomorrow morning. I had a brief word with him after today's proceedings. I think he'll decide that I can continue to represent her. My point was that the agency has had 3 whole months to raise the objection. To show up with that kind of objection after proceedings have started is an unwarranted provocation.
Teleborian will testify on Friday, I gather.
You have to be the one who cross-examines him. On Thursday, Prosecutor Ekstrom explained to the court that after studying maps and photographs and listening to extensive technical conclusions about what had taken place in Gosseberger, he had determined that the evidence indicated that Salander had gone to her father's farmhouse in Gosseberger with the intention of killing him. The strongest link in the chain of evidence was that she had taken a weapon with her, a Polish P-83 Vanat. The fact that Alexander Zalachenko, according to Salander's account, or possibly the cop-killer Ronald Niedermann, according to testimony that Zalachenko had given before he was murdered at Salgrinska, had in turn attempted to kill Salander and bury her in a trench in woods nearby, could in no way be held in mitigation of the fact that she had tracked down her father to Gosseberger with the express intention of killing him. Moreover, she had all but succeeded in that objective when she struck him in the face with an axe. Ekstrom demanded that Salander be convicted of attempted murder or premeditation with the intent to kill, and, in that case, aggravated assault. Salander's own account stated that she had gone to Gosseberger to confront her father, to persuade him to confess to the murders of Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson. This statement was of dramatic significance in the matter of establishing intent. When Ekstrom had finished questioning the witness, Melka Hansen, from the technical unit of the Göteborg police, Advocate Giannini had asked some succinct questions.
Herr Hansen, is there anything at all in your investigation, or in all the technical documentation that you have compiled, which could in any way establish that Lisbeth Salander is lying about her intent regarding the visit to Gosseberger? Can you prove that she went there with the intention of murdering her father?
Hansen thought for a moment.
No,
he said at last.
Do you have anything to say about her intent?
No.
Prosecutor Ekstrom's conclusion, eloquent and extensive as it is therefore speculation?
I believe so.
Is there anything in the forensic evidence that contradicts Lisbeth Salander's statement that she took with her the Polish weapon, a P-83 Vanat, by chance simply because it was in her bag, and she didn't know what she should do with the weapon, having taken it the day before from Sonny Niemannen in Stallerholmen?
No.
Thank you, Giannini said, and sat down.
Those were her only words throughout Hansen's testimony, which had lasted 1 hour. Wardenshuh left the section's apartment on Artilleriegarten at 6 on Thursday evening, with a feeling that he was under ominous clouds of turmoil, of imminent ruin. For several weeks he had known that his title as director, that is, chief of the section for special analysis, was but a meaningless label. His opinions, protests, and entreaties carried no weight. Clinton had taken over all decision-making. If the section had been an open and public institution, this would not have been a problem. He would simply have gone to his superior and lodged his protests. As things stood now, there was no one he could protest to. He was alone and subject to the mercy or disfavour of a man whom he regarded as insane. And the worst of it was that Clinton's authority was absolute. Snot-nosed kids like Sandberg and faithful retainers like Nystrom, they all seemed to jump to obey the fatally ill lunatic's every whim. No question that Clinton was a soft-spoken authority who was not working for his own gain. He would even acknowledge that Clinton was working in the best interests of the section, or at least in what he regarded as its best interests. The whole organization seemed to be in freefall, indulging in a collective fantasy in which experienced colleagues refused to admit that their every movement, every decision that was made and implemented, only led them one step closer to the abyss. Wardenshuh felt a pressure in his chest as he turned onto Linnegatan, where he had found a parking spot earlier that day. He disabled the alarm and was about to open the car door when he heard a movement behind him. He turned around, squinting against the sun. It was a few seconds before he recognized the stately man on the sidewalk before him.
"Good evening, Herr Wardenshuh,"
Ed Klinth said.
"I haven't been out in the field in 10 years, and today I felt that my presence might be appropriate."
Wardenshuh looked in confusion at the two plainclothes policemen flanking Ed Klinth. Boblanski, he knew, but not the other man. Suddenly he guessed what was going to happen.
"It is my unenviable duty to inform you that the Prosecutor General has decided that you are to be arrested for such a long string of crimes that it will surely take weeks to compile a comprehensive catalogue of them."
"What's going on here?" Wardenshuh said indignantly.
"What is going on at this moment is that you are being arrested, suspected of being an accessory to murder. You are also suspected of extortion, bribery, illegal telephone tapping, several counts of criminal forgery, criminal embezzlement of funds, participation in breaking and entering, misuse of authority, espionage, and a long list of other lesser, but that's not to say insignificant, offences. The two of us are going to Kungsholmen to have a very serious talk in peace and quiet." "I haven't committed murder," Wardenshuh said breathlessly. "That will have to be established by the investigation." "It was Clinton." "It was always Clinton," Wardenshuh said.
Ed Klinth nodded in satisfaction. Every police officer knows that there are two classic ways to conduct the interrogation of a suspect: the bad cop and the good cop. The bad cop threatens, swears, slams his fist on the table, and generally behaves aggressively, with the intent of scaring the suspect into submission and confession. The good cop, often a small, grey-haired, elderly man, offers cigarettes and coffee, nods sympathetically and speaks in a reasonable tone. Many policemen, though not all, also know that the good cop's interrogation technique is by far a superior way to get results. The tough-as-nails veteran thief will be least impressed by the bad cop, and the uncertain amateur who might be frightened into a confession by a bad cop would in all likelihood have confessed everything anyway, regardless of the technique used. Blomqvist listened to the questioning of Birger Wardenshuh from an adjoining room. His presence had been the topic of a good deal of internal argument before Ed Klinth decided that he would probably have use for Blomqvist's observation. Blomqvist noticed that Ed Plinth was using a third variant on the police interrogator, the uninterested cop, which in this particular case seemed to be working even better. Ed Plinth strolled into the interrogation room, served coffee in china cups, turned on the tape recorder, and leaned back in his chair.
"This is how it is. We already have every conceivable forensic evidence against you. We have, accordingly, no interest whatsoever in hearing your story, save as confirmation of what we already know. But the question we might want an answer to is, why? How could you be so idiotic as to decide to begin liquidating individuals in Sweden, just as we saw happen in Chile under the Pinochet dictatorship? The tape is rolling. If you have anything to say, now is the time. If you don't want to talk, I'll turn off the tape recorder, and then we'll remove your tie and shoelaces and accommodate you in a cell upstairs, while we wait for a lawyer, a trial, and in due course, sentencing."
Ed Clinth then took a sip of coffee and sat in silence. When nothing was said for 2 minutes, he reached out and turned off the tape recorder. He stood up.
"I'll see that you're taken upstairs in a few minutes. Good evening." "I didn't murder anyone,"
Vardensha said when Ed Plinth had already opened the door. Ed Plinth paused on the threshold.
"I'm not interested in having a general discussion with you. If you want to explain yourself, then I'll sit down and turn the tape recorder back on. All of Swedish officialdom, and the Prime Minister in particular, is eagerly waiting to hear what you have to say. If you tell me, then I can go and see the Prime Minister tonight to give him your version of events. If you don't tell me, you will be charged and convicted anyway." "Please sit down,"
Vardensjö said. It was evident to everyone that he was resigned to his fate. Blomqvist exhaled. He was there with Figueroa, Prosecutor Gustafsson, the otherwise anonymous Seppo officer Stefan, and two other altogether nameless individuals. Blomqvist suspected that one of them at least was there to represent the Minister of Justice.
"I had nothing to do with the murders,"
Vardensjö said when Ed Plinth started the tape recorder again.
"Murders?" Blomqvist whispered to Figueroa.
"Shh," she said. "It was Clinton and Gullberg. I had no idea what they intended, I swear. I was utterly shocked when I heard that Gullberg had shot Zalichenko. I couldn't believe it. I simply couldn't believe it. And when I heard about Björk, I thought I was going to have a heart attack."
"Tell me about Björk's murder,"
Ed Plinth said, without altering his tone.
"How was it carried out?"
"Clinton hired some people. I don't even know how it happened, but it was two Yugoslavs. Serbs, if I'm not mistaken. Georg Nystrom gave them the contract and paid them afterwards. When I found out, I knew it would end in disaster."
"Should we take this from the beginning?" Ed Plinth said. "When did you first start working for the section?"
Once Vardensjö had begun to talk, he could not be stopped. The interview lasted for almost 5 hours. Chapter 26. Friday, July 15th. Teleborian's appearance inspired confidence as he sat in the witness box in the courtroom on Friday morning. He was questioned by Prosecutor Ekström for some 90 minutes, and he replied with calm authority to every question. The expression on his face was sometimes concerned and sometimes amused. "To sum up," Ekström said, leafing through his sheaf of papers, "it is your judgment as a psychiatrist of long standing that Lisbeth Salander suffers from paranoid schizophrenia?"
"I have said that it is unusually difficult to make a precise evaluation of her condition. The patient is, as you know, almost autistic in her relation to doctors and other figures of authority. My assessment is that she suffers from a serious mental disorder, but at the present time I cannot give an exact diagnosis, nor can I determine what stage of the psychosis she is in, without more extensive study."
"At any rate, you don't consider her to be sane?"
"Indeed, her entire history presents most compelling proof that she is not."
"You have been allowed to read what Lisbeth Salander has termed her autobiography, which she has presented to the district court. What are your comments on this?"
Teleborian threw up his hands and shrugged.
"How would you judge the credibility of her account?"
"There is no credibility. It is a series of assertions about various individuals, one story more fantastical than the other.
Taken as a whole, her written explanation confirms our suspicions that she suffers from paranoid schizophrenia.
Could you give an example?
The most obvious is, of course, the description of the alleged rape by her guardian, Advocate Bureman.
Could you expand on that?
The description is extremely detailed. It is a classic example of the sort of grotesque fantasy that children are capable of. There are plenty of parallel examples from familial incest cases in which the child gives an account which falls through due to its utter improbability and for which there is no forensic evidence. These are erotic fantasies which even children of a very young age can have, almost as if they were watching a horror film on television.
But Lisbeth Salander is not a child. She is a grown woman, Ekstrom said.
That is correct, although it remains to be seen exactly what her mental level may be. But, basically, you are correct. She is a grown woman, and presumably she believes in the account she has presented.
So you're saying it is all lies?
No, if she believes what she says, then it is not a lie. It's a story which shows that she cannot distinguish fantasy from reality.
So she was not raped by Advocate Bureman?
No. There is no likelihood of that at all. She needs expert care.
You yourself appeared in Lisbeth Salander's account.
Yes, and that is rather intriguing. But once again, it's a figment of her imagination. If we are to believe the poor girl, then I'm something approximate to a paedophile.
He smiled and continued.
But this is all just another expression of what I was speaking of before. In Salander's autobiography, we are told that she was abused by being placed in restraints for long spells at St. Stephen's, and that I came to her room at night. This is a classic manifestation of her inability to interpret reality. Or rather, she is giving reality to her own interpretation.
Thank you. I leave it to the defence, if Fru Giannini has any questions.
Since Giannini had not had many questions or objections during the first 2 days of the trial, those in the courtroom expected that she would once again ask some obligatory questions and then bring the questioning to an end.
This really is an embarrassingly deficient effort by the defence,
Ekstrom thought.
Yes, I do, Giannini said. I do, in fact, have a number of questions, and they may take some time. It's 11:30 now. May I propose that we break for lunch and that I be allowed to carry out my cross-examination of the witness after lunch without interruption?
Judge Everson agreed that the court should adjourn for lunch. Anderson was accompanied by two uniformed officers when he placed his huge hand on Superintendent Nystrom's shoulder outside the Mester Anders restaurant on Handwerkergarten at noon precisely. Nystrom looked up in amazement at the man who was shoving his police ID right under his nose.
"Hello? You're under arrest, suspected of being an accessory to murder and attempted murder. The charges will be explained to you by the Prosecutor General at a hearing this afternoon. I suggest that you come along peacefully," he said.
Nystrom did not seem to process what Anderson was saying, but he could see that he was a man you went along with without protest. Inspector Poblansky was accompanied by Mudig and seven uniformed officers when Stefan Blad of the Constitutional Protection Unit admitted them at exactly noon into the locked section that comprised the domain of the security police at Kungsholmen. They walked through the halls behind Blad until he stopped and pointed at an office door. The Chief of Secretariat's assistant looked up and was utterly perplexed when Poblansky held up his ID.
"Kindly remain where you are. This is a police action."
He strode to the inner door. Chief of Secretariat Albert Schenke was on the phone.
"What is this interruption?" Schenke said.
"I am Criminal Inspector Jan Poblansky. You are under arrest for violation of the Swedish Constitution. There is a long list of specific points in the charge, all of which will be explained to you this afternoon."
"This is outrageous," Schenke said.
"It most certainly is," Poblansky said.
He had Schenker's office sealed and then placed two officers on guard outside the door with instructions to let no one cross the threshold. They had permission to use their batons and even draw their service weapons if anyone tried to enter the sealed office by force. They continued their procession down the hall until Blad pointed to another door, and the procedure was repeated with Chief of Budget Gustav Atterbom. Inspector Holmberg had the Södermalm Armed Response Team as backup when at exactly noon he knocked on the door of an office rented temporarily on the fourth floor just across the street from Millennium's offices on Goethegarten. Since no one opened the door, Holmberg ordered the Södermalm police to force the lock, but the door was opened a crack before the crowbar was used.
"Police," Holmberg said, "come out with your hands up."
"I'm a policeman myself," Inspector Mortensen said.
"I know, and you have licenses for a great many guns."
"Yes, well, I'm on assignment."
"I think not," Holmberg said.
He accepted the assistance of his colleagues in placing Mortensen against the wall so he could confiscate his service weapon.
"You are under arrest for illegal telephone tapping, gross dereliction of duty, repeated break-ins at Mikael Blomqvist's apartment on Bellmansgatan, and additional counts. Handcuff him."
Holmberg took a swift look around the room and saw that there was enough electronic equipment to furnish a recording studio. He detailed an officer to guard the premises, but told him to sit still on a chair so he would not leave any fingerprints. As Mortensen was being led through the front door of the building, Cortez took a series of 22 photographs with his Nikon. He was, of course, no professional photographer, and the quality left something to be desired. But the best images were sold the next day to an evening newspaper for an obscene sum of money. Figuerola was the only police officer participating in the day's raids who encountered an unexpected incident. She had backup from the Norman team and three colleagues from SIS when at noon she walked through the front door of the building on Artillerygatan and went up the stairs to the top-floor apartment, registered in the name of Bellona, Inc. The operation had been planned on short notice. As soon as the group was assembled outside the door of the apartment, she gave the go-ahead. Two burly officers from the Norman team raised an 85-pound steel battering ram and opened the door with two well-aimed blows. The team, equipped with bulletproof vests and assault rifles, took control of the apartment within 10 seconds of the doors being forced. According to surveillance carried out at dawn, five individuals identified as members of the section had arrived at the apartment that morning. All five were apprehended and put in handcuffs. Figuerola was wearing a bulletproof vest. She went through the apartment, which had been the headquarters of the section since the '60s, and flung open one door after another. She was going to need an archaeologist to sort through the reams and reams of paper that filled the rooms. A few seconds after she entered the apartment, she opened the door to a small room towards the back and discovered that it was used for overnight stays. She found herself eye to eye with Jonas Sandberg. He had been a question mark during that morning's assignment of tasks, as the surveillance officer detailed to watch him had lost track of him the evening before. His car had been parked on Kungsholmen, and he had not been home to his apartment during the night. This morning they had not expected to locate and apprehend him. They man the place at night for security reasons, of course, and Sandberg sleeps over after the night shift. Sandberg had on only his underpants and seemed to be dazed with sleep. He reached for his service weapon on the bedside table, but Figuerola bent over and swept the weapon away from him onto the floor. "Jonas Sandberg, you are under arrest as a suspect and accessory to the murders of Gunnar Björk and Alexander Zalachenko, and as an accomplice in the attempted murders of Mikael Blomqvist and Erika Berger. Now get your trousers on." Sandberg threw a punch at Figuerola. She blocked it instinctively.
"You must be joking," she said.
She took hold of his arm and twisted his wrist so hard that he was forced backwards to the floor. She flipped him over onto his stomach and put her knee in the small of his back. She handcuffed him herself. It was the first time she had used handcuffs on an assignment since she began at SIS. She handed Sandberg over to one of the backup team and continued her passage through the apartment until she opened the last door at the very back. According to the blueprints, this was a small cubbyhole looking out onto the courtyard. She stopped in the doorway and looked at the most emaciated figure she had ever seen. She did not for one second doubt that here was a person who was mortally ill.
"Frederick Clinton, you are under arrest as an accomplice to murder, for attempted murder, and for a long list of further crimes," she said. "Stay where you are in bed. We've called an ambulance to take you to Kungsholmen."
Malm was stationed immediately outside the building on Artillerygatan.
Unlike Cortez, he knew how to handle his digital Nikon. He used a short telephoto lens, and the pictures he took were of excellent quality. They showed the members of the section, one by one, being led out through the front door and down to the police cars, and finally the ambulance that arrived to pick up Clinton. His eyes were fixed on the lens as the shutter clicked. Clinton looked nervous and confused. The photograph later won the Picture of the Year award. Chapter 27. Friday, July 15th. Judge Everson banged his gavel at 12:30 and decreed that district court proceedings were thereby resumed. He noticed that a third person had appeared at Advocate Giannini's table. It was Holger Palmgren in a wheelchair.
"Hello, Holger," Judge Everson said. "I haven't seen you in a courtroom in quite a while."
"Good day to you, Judge Everson. Some cases are so complicated that these younger lawyers need a little assistance."
"I thought you had retired."
"I've been ill, but Advocate Giannini engaged me as assistant counsel in this case."
"I see."
Giannini cleared her throat. "It is germane to the case that Advocate Palmgren was, until his illness, Lisbeth Salander's guardian."
"I have no intention of commenting on that matter," Judge Everson said.
He nodded to Giannini to begin, and she stood up. She had always disliked the Swedish tradition of carrying on court proceedings informally while sitting around a table, almost as though the occasion were a dinner party. She felt better when she could speak standing up. "I think we should begin with the concluding comments from this morning. Dr. Teleborian, what leads you so consistently to dismiss as untrue everything that Lisbeth Salander says?"
"Because her statements so obviously are untrue," replied Teleborian.
He was relaxed. Giannini turned to the judge.
"Judge Everson, Dr. Teleborian claims that Lisbeth Salander tells lies and that she fantasizes. The defense will now demonstrate that every word in her autobiography is true. We will present copious documentation, both visual and written, as well as the testimony of witnesses. We have now reached the point in this trial when the prosecutor has presented the principal elements of his case. We have listened, and we now know the exact nature of the accusations against Lisbeth Salander."
Giannini's mouth was suddenly dry, and she felt her hands shake. She took a deep breath and sipped her mineral water. Then she placed her hands in a firm grip on the back of the chair so that they would not betray her nervousness. "From the prosecutor's presentation, we may conclude that he has a great many opinions, but a woeful shortage of evidence. He believes that Lisbeth Salander shot Carl Magnus Lundin in Stalaholmen. He claims that she went to Gossaberga to kill her father. He assumes that my client is a paranoid schizophrenic and mentally ill in every sense. And he bases this assumption on information from a single source, to wit, Dr. Teleborian." She paused to catch her breath and forced herself to speak slowly. "As it now stands, the case presented by the prosecutor rests on the testimony of Dr. Teleborian. If he is right, then my client would be best served by receiving the expert psychiatric care that both he and the prosecutor are seeking." Pause. "But if Dr. Teleborian is wrong, this prosecution case must be seen in a different light. Furthermore, if he is lying, then my client is now, here in this courtroom, being subjected to a violation of her civil rights, a violation that has gone on for many years." She turned to face Ekstrom. "What we shall do this afternoon is to show that your witness is a false witness, and that you as prosecutor have been deceived into accepting these false testimonies." Teleborian flashed a smile. He held out his hands and nodded to Giannini, as if applauding her presentation. Giannini now turned to the judge.
"Your Honour, I will show that Dr. Teleborian's so-called forensic psychiatric investigation is nothing but a deception from start to finish. I will show that he is lying about Lisbeth Salander. I will show that my client has in the past been subjected to gross violation of her rights, and I will show that she is just as sane and intelligent as anyone in this room. "Excuse me, but—" Ekstrom began. "Just a moment." She raised a finger. "I have for 2 days allowed you to talk, uninterrupted. Now it's my turn."
She turned back to Judge Everson.
"I would not make so serious an accusation before the court if I did not have ample evidence to support it."
"By all means, continue," the judge said. "But I don't want to hear any long-winded conspiracy theories. Bear in mind that you can be charged with slander for false statements that are made before a court."
"Thank you. I will bear that in mind."
She turned to Teleborian. He still seemed entertained by the situation.
"The defense has repeatedly asked to be allowed to examine Lisbeth Salander's medical records from the time when she, in her early teens, was committed to your care at St. Stephen's. Why have we not been shown these records?"
"Because a district court decreed that they were classified. That decision was made out of solicitude for Lisbeth Salander. But if a higher court were to rescind that decision, I would naturally hand them over."
"Thank you. For how many nights during the 2 years that Lisbeth Salander spent at St. Stephen's was she kept in restraints?"
"I couldn't recall that offhand."
"She herself claims that it was 380 out of the total of 786 days and nights she spent at St. Stephen's."
"I can't possibly answer as to the exact number of days, but that is a fantastic exaggeration. Where do those figures come from?"
"From her autobiography."
"And you believe that today she is able to remember accurately each night she was kept in restraints?" "Well, that's preposterous."
"Is it? How many nights do you recall?"
"Elizabeth Salander was an extremely aggressive and violence-prone patient, and undoubtedly she was placed in a stimulus-free room on a number of occasions. Perhaps I should explain the purpose of a stimulus-free room."
"Thank you. That won't be necessary. According to theory, it is a room in which a patient is denied any sensory input that might provoke agitation. For how many days and nights did 13-year-old Lisbeth Salander lie strapped down in such a room?"
"It would be, I would estimate perhaps on 30 occasions during the time she was at the hospital."
30. "Now that's only a fraction of the 380 that she claims."
"Undeniably."
"Not even 10% of her figure."
"Yes."
"Would her medical records perhaps give us more accurate information?"
"It's possible."
"Excellent," Giannini said, taking out a large sheaf of paper from her briefcase.
"Then I ask to be allowed to hand over to the court a copy of Lisbeth Salander's medical records from St. Stephen's. I have counted the number of notes about the restraining straps, and find that the figure is 381, one more than my client claims."
Teleborian's eyes widened.
"Stop. This is classified information. Where did you get that from?"
"I got it from a reporter at Millennium Magazine. It can hardly be classified if it's lying around a newspaper's offices. Perhaps I should add that extracts from these medical records were published today in Millennium. I believe, therefore, that even this district court should have the opportunity to look at the records themselves."
"This is illegal."
"No, it isn't. Lisbeth Salander has given her permission for the extracts to be published. My client has nothing to hide."
"Your client has been declared incompetent, and has no right to make any such decision for herself."
"We'll come back to the declaration of incompetence. But first we need to examine what happened to her at St. Stephen's."
Judge Everson frowned as he accepted the papers that Giannini handed to him.
"I haven't made a copy for the prosecutor. He received a copy of this privacy-invading document more than a month ago."
"How did that happen?" the judge said.
"Professor Ekstrom got a copy of these classified records from Teleborian at a meeting which took place in his office at 5 p.m. on Saturday, June 4th, this year."
"Is that correct?"
Judge Everson said. Ekstrom's first impulse was to deny it. Then he realized that Giannini might somehow have evidence.
"I requested permission to read parts of the records if I signed a confidentiality agreement," Ekstrom said. "I had to make sure that Salander had the history she was alleged to have."
"Thank you," Giannini said. "This means that we now have confirmation that Dr. Teleborian not only tells lies, but also broke the law by disseminating records that he himself claims are classified."
"Duly noted," said the judge.
Judge Everson was suddenly very alert. In a most unorthodox way, Giannini had launched a serious attack on a witness, and she had already made mincemeat of an important part of his testimony. And she claims that she can document everything she says. Judge Everson adjusted his glasses.
Dr. Teleborian, based on these records which you yourself wrote, could you now tell me how many days Lisbeth Salander was kept in restraints?
I have no recollection that it could have been so extensive. But if that's what the records say, then I have to believe it.
A total of 381 days and nights. Does that not strike you as excessive?
It is unusual, yes.
How would you perceive it if you were 13 years old, and someone strapped you to a steel-framed bed for more than a year? Would it feel like torture?
You have to understand that the patient was dangerous to herself as well as to others.
Okay. Let's look at whether she was dangerous to herself. Has Lisbeth Salander ever injured herself?
There were such misgivings.
I'll repeat the question. Has Lisbeth Salander ever injured herself, yes or no?
As psychiatrists, we must teach ourselves to interpret the overall picture. With regard to Lisbeth Salander, you can see on her body, for example, a multitude of tattoos and piercings, which are a form of self-destructive behaviour and a way of damaging one's own body. We can interpret that as a manifestation of self-hate.
Giannini turned to Salander.
Are your tattoos a manifestation of self-hate? She said. No, Salander said.
Giannini turned back to Teleborian.
So you believe that I am also dangerous to myself because I wear earrings and actually have a tattoo in a private place?
Almgren snickered, but he managed to transform the snicker into a clearing of his throat.
No, not at all. Tattoos can also be part of a social ritual.
Are you saying that Lisbeth Salander is not part of this social ritual?
You can see for yourself that her tattoos are grotesque and extend over large parts of her body. That is no normal measure of fetishism or body decoration.
What percentage?
Excuse me?
At what percentage of tattooed body surface does it stop being fetishism and become a mental illness?
You're distorting my words.
Am I? How is it that, in your opinion, it is part of a wholly acceptable social ritual when it applies to me or to other young people, but it becomes dangerous when it's a matter of evaluating my client's mental state?
As a psychiatrist, I have to look at the whole picture. The tattoos are merely an indicator. As I have already said, it is one of many indicators which need to be taken into account when I evaluate her condition.
Giannini was silent for a few seconds, as she fixed Teleborian with her gaze. Now she spoke very slowly.
But, Dr. Teleborian, you began strapping down my client when she was 12 years old, going on 13. At that time she did not have a single tattoo, did she?
Teleborian hesitated, and Giannini went on.
I presume that you did not strap her down because you predicted that she would begin tattooing herself sometime in the future.
Of course not. Her tattoos had nothing to do with her condition in 1991.
With that, we are back to my original question. Did Lisbeth Salander ever injure herself in a way that would justify keeping her bound to a bed for a whole year? For example, did she cut herself with a knife or a razor blade or anything like that?
Teleborian looked unsure for a second.
No, I used the tattoos as an example of self-destructive behaviour.
And we have just agreed that tattoos are a legitimate part of a social ritual. I asked why you restrained her for a year, and you replied that it was because she was a danger to herself.
We had reason to believe that she was a danger to herself.
Reason to believe. So you're saying that you restrained her because you guessed something.
We carried out assessments.
I have now been asking the same question for about 5 minutes. You claim that my client's self-destructive behaviour was one reason why she was strapped down for a total of more than a year out of the 2 years she was in your care. Can you please finally give me some examples of the self-destructive behaviour she evidenced at the age of 12?
The girl was extremely undernourished, for example. This was partially due to the fact that she refused food. We suspected anorexia.
I see. Was she anorexic? As you can see, my client is even today uncommonly thin and fine-boned.
Well, it's difficult to answer that question. I would have to observe her eating habits for quite a long time.
You did observe her eating habits?
For 2 years. And now you're suggesting that you confused anorexia with the fact that my client is small and thin.
You say that she refused food.
We were compelled to force-feed her on several occasions.
And why was that?
Because she refused to eat, of course.
Giannini turned to her client. Lisbeth, is it true that you refused to eat at St. Stefan's?
Yes.
And why was that?
Because that bastard was mixing psychotropic drugs into my food.
I see. So Dr. Teleborian wanted to give you medicine. Why didn't you want to take it?
I didn't like the medicine I was being given. It made me sluggish. I couldn't think. And I was sedated for most of the time I was awake. And the bastard refused to tell me what the drugs contained.
So you refused to take the medicine?
Yes. Then he began putting the crap in my food instead. So I stopped eating. Every time something had been put in my food, I stopped eating for 5 days.
So you had to go hungry?
Not always. Several of the attendants smuggled sandwiches in to me on various occasions. One in particular gave me food late at night. That happened quite often.
So you think that the nursing staff at St. Stephen's saw that you were hungry and gave you food so that you would not have to starve?
That was during the period when I was battling with this bastard over psychotropic drugs.
Tell us what happened.
He tried to drug me. I refused to take his medicine. He started putting it in my food. I refused to eat. He started force-feeding me. I began vomiting up the food.
So there was a completely rational reason why you refused the food?
Yes.
It was not because you didn't want food.
No, I was often hungry.
And since you left St. Stefan's, do you eat regularly?
I eat when I'm hungry.
Would it be correct to say that a conflict arose between you and Dr. Teleborian?
You could say that.
You were sent to St. Stefan's because you had thrown gasoline at your father and set him on fire.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Because he abused my mother.
Did you ever explain that to anyone?
Yes.
And who was that?
I told the police who interviewed me, the social workers, the doctors, a pastor, and that bastard.
By that bastard you are referring to
that man,
she pointed at Dr. Teleborian.
Why do you call him a bastard? When I first arrived at St. Stephen's, I tried to explain to him what had happened.
And what did Dr. Teleborian say?
He didn't want to listen to me. He claimed that I was fantasizing, and as punishment I was to be strapped down until I stopped fantasizing. And then he tried to force-feed me psychotropic drugs.
This is nonsense, Teleborian said.
Is that why you won't speak to him?
I haven't said a word to the bastard since the night I turned 13. I was strapped to the bed. It was my birthday present to myself.
Giannini turned to Teleborian.
This sounds as if the reason my client refused to eat was that she did not want the psychotropic drugs you were forcing upon her.
It's possible that she views it that way.
And how do you view it?
I had a patient who was abnormally difficult. I maintain that her behaviour showed that she was a danger to herself, but this might be a question of interpretation. However, she was violent and exhibited psychotic behaviour. There is no doubt that she was dangerous to others. She came to St. Stephen's after she tried to murder her father.
We'll get to that later. For 381 of those days you kept her in restraints. Could it have been that you used strapping as a way to punish my client when she didn't do as you said?
That is utter nonsense.
Is it? I notice that, according to the records, the majority of the strapping occurred during the first year. 320 of 381 instances. Why was the strapping discontinued?
I suppose the patient changed her behaviour and became less agitated.
Is it not true that your measures were considered unnecessarily brutal by other members of the staff?
How do you mean?
Is it not true that the staff lodged complaints against the force-feeding of Lisbeth Salander, among other things?
Inevitably people will arrive at differing evaluations. This is nothing unusual.
but it became a burden to force-feed her because she resisted so violently, because she refused to take psychotropic drugs, which made her listless and passive. She had no problem eating when she was not being drugged. Wouldn't that have been a more reasonable method of treatment than resorting to forcible measures?
If you don't mind my saying so, Fru Giannini, I am actually a physician. I suspect that my medical expertise is rather more extensive than yours. It is my job to determine what medical treatments should be employed.
It's true. I'm not a physician, Dr. Teleborian. However, I am not entirely lacking in expertise. Besides my qualifications as a lawyer, I was also trained as a psychologist at Stockholm University. This is necessary background training in my profession.
You could have heard a pin drop in the courtroom. Both Ekström and Teleborian stared in astonishment at Giannini. She continued inexorably.
Is it not correct that your methods of treating my client eventually resulted in serious disagreements between you and your superior, Dr. Johannes Kaldin, head physician at the time?
No, that is not correct.
Dr. Kaldin passed away several years ago and cannot give testimony. But here in court we have someone who met Dr. Kaldin on several occasions, namely my assistant counsel Holger Palmgren. She turned to him. Can you tell us how that came about?
Palmgren cleared his throat. He still suffered from the after-effects of his stroke and had to concentrate to pronounce the words.
I was appointed as trustee for Lisbeth Salander after her mother was so severely beaten by Lisbeth's father that she was disabled and could no longer take care of her daughters. She suffered permanent brain damage and repeated brain hemorrhages.
You're speaking of Alexander Zalichenko, I presume? Ekström was leaning forward attentively.
That's correct, Palmgren said.
Ekström said, I would ask you to remember that we are now on a subject which is highly classified.
It's hardly a secret that Alexander Zalichenko persistently abused Lisbeth's mother, Giannini said. Teleborian raised his hand.
The matter is probably not quite as self-evident as Fru Giannini is presenting it.
What do you mean by that? Giannini said.
There is no doubt that Lisbeth Salander witnessed a family tragedy, that something triggered a serious beating in 1991. But there is no documentation to suggest that this was a situation that went on for many years, as Fru Giannini claims. It could have been an isolated incident or a quarrel that got out of hand. If truth be told, there is not even any documentation to point towards Herr Zalichenko as Lisbeth's mother's aggressor. We have been informed that she was a prostitute, so there could have been a number of other possible perpetrators.
Giannini looked in astonishment at Teleborian. She seemed to be speechless for a moment. Then her eyes bored into him.
Could you expand on that? She said.
What I mean is that in practice we have only Lisbeth Salander's assertions to go on.
And?
First of all, there were two sisters. Twins, in fact. Camilla Salander has never made any such claims. Indeed, she has denied that such a thing occurred. And if there was abuse to the extent your client maintains, then it would naturally have been noted in social welfare reports and so forth.
Is there an interview with Camilla Salander that we might examine?
Interview?
Do you have any documentation to show that Camilla Salander was even asked about what occurred at their home?
Salander squirmed in her seat at the mention of her sister. She glanced at Giannini.
I presume that the Social Welfare Agency filed a report.
You have just stated that Camilla Salander never made any assertions that Alexander Zalichenko abused their mother, that on the contrary she denied it. That was a categorical statement. Where did you get that information?
Teleborian sat in silence for several seconds. Giannini could see his eyes change when he realized he had made a mistake. He could anticipate what it was that she wanted to introduce, but there was no way to avoid the question.
I seem to remember that it appeared in the police report, he said at last.
You seem to remember? I myself have searched high and low for police reports about the incident on Lundegarten during which Alexander Zalichenko was severely burned. The only ones available are the brief reports written by the officers at the scene.
That's possible.
So I would very much like to know how it is that you were able to read a police report that is not available to the defence?
I can't answer that, Taliborian said. I was shown the report in 1991, when I wrote a forensic psychiatric report on your client after the attempted murder of her father.
Was Prosecutor Ekstrom shown this report? Ekstrom squirmed. He stroked his goatee. By now he knew that he had underestimated Advocate Giannini. However, he had no reason to lie.
Yes, I've seen it.
Why wasn't the defence given access to this material?
I didn't consider it of interest to the trial.
Could you please tell me how you were allowed to see this report? When I asked the police, I was told only that no such report exists.
The report was written by the security police. It's classified.
So Seppo wrote a report on a case involving aggravated assault on a woman and decided to make the report classified.
It was because of the perpetrator, Alexander Zalachenko. He was a political refugee.
Who wrote the report?
Silence.
I don't hear anything. What name was on the title page?
It was written by Gunnar Bjork from the Immigrant Division of SIS.
Thank you. Is that the same Gunnar Bjork who my client claims worked with Dr. Teleborian to fabricate the forensic psychiatric report about her in 1991?
I assume it is.
Giannini turned her attention back to Teleborian.
In 1991, you committed Lisbeth Salander to the secure ward of St. Stephen's Children's Psychiatric Clinic.
That's not correct.
Is it not?
No. Lisbeth Salander was sentenced to the secure psychiatric ward. This was the outcome of an entirely routine legal action in a district court. We're talking about a seriously disturbed minor. That was not my own decision.
In 1991, a district court decided to lock up Lisbeth Salander in a children's psychiatric clinic. Why did the district court make that decision?
The district court made a careful assessment of your client's actions and mental condition. She had tried to murder her father with a gasoline bomb, after all. This is not an activity that a normal teenager would engage in, whether they are tattooed or not.
Teleborian gave her a polite smile.
And what did the district court base their judgment on? If I've understood correctly, they had only one forensic medical assessment to go on. It was written by yourself and a policeman by the name of Gunnar Bjork.
This is about Fröken Salander's conspiracy theories, Fru Giannini. Here I would have to...
Excuse me, but I haven't asked a question yet,
Giannini said, and turned once again to Palmgren.
Holger, we were talking about your meeting, Dr. Teleborian's superior, Dr. Kaldin.
Yes, in my capacity as trustee for Lisbeth Salander. At that time, I had met her only very briefly. Like everyone else, I got the impression that she had a serious mental illness. But since it was my job, I undertook to research her general state of health.
And what did Dr. Kaldin say?
She was Dr. Teleborian's patient, and Dr. Kaldin had not paid her any particular attention except in routine assessments and the like. It wasn't until she had been there for more than a year that I began to discuss how she could be rehabilitated back into society. I suggested a foster family. I don't know exactly what went on internally at St. Stephen's, but after about a year, Dr. Kaldin began to take an interest in her.
How did that manifest itself?
I discovered that he had arrived at an opinion that differed from Dr. Teleborian's,
Palmgren said.
He told me once that he had decided to change the type of care she was receiving. I did not understand until later that he was referring to the strap restraints. Dr. Kaldin had decided that she should not be restrained. He didn't think there was any reason for it.
So he went against Dr. Teleborian's directives?
Ekstrom interrupted.
Objection! That's hearsay.
No, Palmgren said, not entirely. I asked for a report on how Lisbeth Salander was supposed to re-enter society. Dr. Kaldin wrote that report. I still have it today.
He handed a document to Giannini.
Can you tell us what it says?
It's a letter from Dr. Caldeen to me, dated October 1992, which is when Lisbeth had been at St. Stephen's for 19 months. Here Dr. Caldeen expressly writes, I quote, "My decision for the patient not to be restrained or force-fed has also produced the noticeable effect that she is now calm. There is no need for psychotropic drugs. However, the patient is extremely withdrawn and uncommunicative and needs continued supportive therapies." End quote.
So he expressly writes that it was his decision, Giannini said.
That is correct. It was also Dr. Caldeen himself who decided that Lisbeth should be able to re-enter society by being placed with a foster family.
Salander nodded. She remembered Dr. Caldeen the same way she remembered every detail of her stay at St. Stephen's. She had refused to talk to Dr. Caldeen. He was a crazy doctor, another man in a white coat who wanted to root around in her emotions. But he had been friendly and good-natured. She had sat in his office and listened to him when he explained things to her. He had seemed hurt when she did not want to speak to him. Finally, she had looked him in the eye and explained her decision.
"I will never ever talk to you or any other crazy doctor. None of you listen to what I have to say. You can keep me locked up here until I die. That won't change a thing. I won't talk to any of you."
He had looked at her with surprise and hurt in his eyes. Then he had nodded as if he understood.
"Dr. Teleborian," Giannini said, "we have established that you had Lisbeth Salander committed to a children's psychiatric clinic. You were the one who furnished the district court with the report, and this report constituted the only basis for the decisions that were made. Is this correct?"
"That is essentially correct, but I think..."
"You'll have plenty of time to explain what you think. When Lisbeth Salander was about to turn 18, you once again interfered in her life and tried to have her locked up in a clinic."
"This time I wasn't the one who wrote the forensic medical report."
"No, it was written by Dr. Jesper H. Lodemann, a doctoral candidate at that time, and you just happened to be his supervisor. So it was your assessments that caused the report to be approved."
"There's nothing unethical or incorrect in these reports. They were done according to the proper regulations of my profession."
"Now Lisbeth Salander is 27 years old, and for the third time we are in a situation in which you are trying to convince a district court that she is mentally ill and must be committed to a secure psychiatric ward.